Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Listen, kid, you lay off that library dame. Women weaken legs.
Yeah, but I really like this girl, you know?
But let her train you!
Okay, no more fooling around.
Josh, didn't I hear you went and married that library dame before we could record the big show?
Well, yeah, but that was like 20 years ago.
Kid just doesn't want to be a champion. On this week's show, the acclaimed new film Whiplash explores the dark side of mentor-protege relationships. We'll discuss and share our top five movie mentor-proteges. That and more.
Yo, Debbie, it's me, Josh.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM.
You're listening to Film Spotting, where we've all just learned that Josh can do a lot of funny voices, but he can't do Sylvester Stallone.
My Stallone was a little hoarse. I think, I don't know why. He had been doing a lot of screaming in the ring.
I guess. This week on the show, the inspirational tale of a couple down-on-their-luck podcasters who make good with the help of a crusty old radio veteran. Our top five mentor proteges is later in the show.
I don't think Golden Joe DeSoto likes being called crusty.
Good point. Maybe crafty?
Yeah.
Can we go with grizzled?
Sure. He's kind of grizzled.
He's a little grizzled.
But first, our review of a movie about a drummer driven to madness in his pursuit of musical perfection. No, not Animal from the Muppets. I'm talking about Miles Teller in Whiplash.
This place is nice.
I really like the music that they play. Bob Ellis on the drums. I'm part of Schaefer's top jazz orchestra. It's the best music school in the country.
The key is to just relax. Don't worry about the numbers. Don't worry about what the other guys are thinking. You're here for a reason. Have fun.
Five, six, and.
I want to be great.
And you're not.
We got Buddy Rich here.
A little trouble there. You're rushing. Here we go.
Five, six, and.
Were you rushing or were you dragging?
I don't know.
If you deliberately sabotage my band, I will gut you like a pig.
Oh, my dear God. Are you one of those single-tier people?
You are a worthless pansy ass who is now weeping and slobbering all over my drum set like a 9-year-old girl.
On a recent show, Adam, we played a clip from Whiplash in which J.K. Simmons' demanding music instructor berates Miles Teller's aspiring jazz drummer, and I made a joke that he sounded like Arlie Ermey's drill instructor in Full Metal Jacket. I hadn't seen the film yet, but it turns out I was onto something. In both Full Metal Jacket and Whiplash, the harsh demands of a superior play a part in an instance of suicide. And this is a small detail in Whiplash, so don't worry that I've just given the entire picture away. All that is to say, though, that Whiplash, which is written and directed by Damien Chazelle, is a pretty dark film. In his quest to become one of the great jazz drummers of all time, Teller's Andrew alienates family, snuffs out a burgeoning romance, and spills a whole lot of blood. I didn't realize that drumming could involve this much blood, actually. Meanwhile, J.K. Simmons Fletcher, an abusively intense teacher at the elite music school Andrew attends, is on hand to push Andrew even further than that. Their goal is nothing short of perfection. And considering the potential, the value, and the cost of perfection is largely what Whiplash is all about. One thing I've learned about you, Adam, since joining the show is that you have a perfectionist streak. Would you say that's fair?
That's fair.
And to be fair, I can relate. There's a bit of the pot calling the kettle black here. Still, I wonder what it was like for you to watch this striving for musical perfection. Did you find Whiplash affirming of such tendencies or cautionary about them? Perhaps it was something in between. And is the movie itself, which is a bold incorporation of the musical aesthetic in visual form, anywhere close to artistic perfection?
Great stuff. Whether a piece of art can ever be perfect, of course, is a very loaded subject, but it is one I'd maybe like to return to if we have time, because I do think it's interesting to consider in relation to jazz specifically. In the broader sense, I know what you're really getting at is, did I like this movie? Do I think it's a good movie? And yes, I did really like this movie. I think it's a very good film. And the first part of your prompt nails one of the aspects of Whiplash I appreciate the most. It absolutely is both affirming of such striving and cautionary about it, which is really the only honest position to take. I think it would have been so easy for Chazelle to show the personal cost of Andrew's ambition physically, psychologically, socially, and have him renounce that by the end of the film and be in a much healthier place. Maybe be the kid again who could actually play the drums just for fun. But Chazelle, maybe because this is a personal film for him, what little I've read, he was a former jazz protege himself, and now he's an artist, of course, making movies. He knows how disingenuous that would have been. He knows how crucial that drive is in any artistic endeavor. Dangerous, yes, but necessary. And by the end of this film, it's a neat little trick Chazelle has pulled off. He gets to have it both ways. It's crowd-pleasing and inspirational, but also really problematic and disturbing to really think about it from the main character's point of view. So there's this element of cliche to this film in terms of hitting some notes that we want a film like this to hit in terms of being uplifting. And then you sort of find yourself after you've risen out of your seat and find yourself cheering, sitting back down and thinking, what am I excited about? What am I really cheering for? It is dark in that way. And I respect quite a bit that little trick that Chazelle's pulled off.
Yeah, I like that you use the word trick, because that's exactly what he does in a way. All the questions that are at the beginning of this film really are still there, aren't they? When the lights come up. And that's what I loved about it, because it explores all the possibilities of this being cautionary and how the direction this kid is going is dangerous for himself personally, certainly for his relationships, yeah, and even for his physical health. But then it opens up to consider, without ever really condoning the methods that the Simmons character uses, but to make us really ask, is there something that's worth all of this that the kid has gone through? And maybe perfection, we don't want to get too derailed by that as a topic.
Right.
Maybe it's just to be your best or to truly achieve something, it's going to take some sort of sacrificing, some sort of suffering. And then you ask yourself, okay, is that worth it? Or would I be better off having other elements of my life be healthier and richer, but I never attained that maybe one moment? And we get that moment. This was a movie that very much worked for me personally as a viewer along the same trajectory as Frank, the Michael Fassbender film, with him in the papier-mâché head mask leading a band. And both pictures I was enjoying quite a bit all the way through, wasn't crazy about, and both of them culminates in a performance, a musical performance that ties everything together, brings it all together in this climactic scene, and also leaves you still questioning, I think. So this doesn't wrap things up neatly, but I can totally see how an audience would go out of this picture thinking, oh, wow, how inspiring that was. But really, the Teller character, Andrew, he doesn't have any clear idea of how he should live his life as a jazz artist where this film ends than maybe he did a few scenes earlier.
Right.
And that's what I liked about it.
To your point specifically about the questions this movie is posing, it occurred to me that I actually think it would be a really fun personality test to give someone, to have them watch a scene that happens near the end of the movie. And I'll be vague here to not spoil anything, but there's a conversation where Fletcher, J.K. Simmons, lays out his rationale. He explains why he pushed Andrew and his whole ensemble as hard as he did. Take that explanation out of the context of the movie. You're just meeting this instructor on the street and hearing his teaching philosophy. I'm curious how many people would listen and without hesitation dismiss him and say, I would never want to be taught by that man. I couldn't undergo that type of process. I don't even want to spend any time with him, much less be instructed by him. How many people would listen and think, okay, I get it. It sounds rough, but I get it. It could all be worth it. Sign me up. Now take those people, the people that said sign me up, have them watch the movie. Hear his philosophy where this scene appears within the context of the movie. You've seen his behavior. You see how far he goes. You see all the damage he's caused. How many of those people would still say, sign me up? And how many of them would switch their answer to, no way? I certainly wasn't unequivocally, enthusiastically on board, but Josh, I was still on board. That's how messed up I am. That's how much I buy into this notion of artistic greatness. Not perfection, as you said, because I don't think it's attainable in art anyway. This isn't math or science. There's no formula. There's no hard answers, no hard right answers. But in the striving for a form of perfection, maybe you achieve something close. Maybe you achieve something transcendent. And in that way, maybe it is all worth it.
And that's another trick the movie pulls, is that just when you think you've got this guy figured out and demonized, here comes that speech. And yeah, I was in the same boat as you. I'm thinking, well, he's maybe got it figured out here. And it ties into, you know, the one line, if it's the same conversation I'm thinking of, and I'm pretty sure it is when he says something about the worst two words in the English language are good job.
Good job.
And doesn't that tie into this culture now of every kid's team gets a trophy? Right. Every kid comes home, whether you're in last place or first place, with a ribbon or something. Mm-hmm. And that's the idea behind it, is that we're all just here to learn. Now, different contexts, of course, that happens with little kids. Here is, well, you know, a young adult, college age, and maybe making that transition between, OK, you're bad. Get out of my classroom. I'm bringing another guy in. And at some point, you do have to have that restriction for the art to breathe. And so you see where he's coming from. And the movie shifts your perspective. Another interesting question to ask along the lines of yours would be, what shifts did you make during this film? Like, where were you, you know, agreeing with Simmons? Where did you just want to, like, get him fired?
Yeah.
And I think it's a real emotional trajectory that this picture takes you through.
There's no doubt. And I think a shorter version of this same challenge, it comes in the form of a question that happens in a dinner table conversation much earlier in the film, where Andrew, in justifying his pursuit of this ambition, says basically, I'd rather die at 34, but be somebody that people are still talking about 50, 60 years from now versus someone who lives to be 90.
Yeah.
And nobody cares about, not memorable in any way. That's another question I think a lot of people listening probably have asked themselves at some point. And that reaching for greatness, I said this movie was one of my most anticipated movies of the year because that's something I am always drawn to. Those kinds of stories is something that has always fascinated me for whatever reason. It came up a lot recently in connection with my top five movie tattoos. Remember, I was paying tribute to, you know, Man on Wire, Philippe Petit pulling off this unbelievable feat and all that jazz, Joe Gideon, a character pursuing this perfection and always failing. It also connects, Josh, with something else I'm always preoccupied with. It comes up a lot here on the show, which is purpose. One of the reasons I think this type of ambition is so attractive, even though it's so obviously potentially harmful, is that it simplifies everything.
Sure.
If your entire focus is this goal, whatever that goal is, then virtually every decision you have to make has already been made for you, or is at least much easier to decide. There's another great scene in Whiplash that gets directly at this in both dialogue and also how it's shot, which I know we want to talk about a little bit. Andrew takes this girl he's interested in. He asked her out at the movie theater. She's selling popcorn. Nicole, out for pizza. And she reveals that she really doesn't know what she wants to do with her life. There's no real reason why she decided to go to school at Fordham. It was just there. She doesn't know what her major is yet. She's still searching. It's this very kind of vulnerable moment. And Andrew's reaction, he's a nice enough kid, at least at this point in the film. His reaction to that isn't mean or hurtful, but his questions are just pointed enough that it's quite clear to her and to us that he just cannot fathom being so directionless, so lacking in drive, so lacking in purpose. And she certainly senses it, and the exchange ends awkwardly. But the reason we sense it, Josh, it isn't just the words. It's because of the editing here in this sequence. It's been, up to this point in the conversation, a pretty standard shot, reverse shot conversation. And then he asks that first leading question, and she recognizes the subtext, and the pace of the editing quickens. The editor here is Tom Cross. Quickens just for that back and forth, a little bit of, if you've seen the movie, double time swing, if you will, and it just completely heightens the intensity of that scene and draws our focus into what's really going on in the back of his mind, which we can sense a little bit based on his personality, but it's really there because of the way that scene is captured and the way it plays out rhythmically.
Hey. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good.
The usual?
Nah. Look, I don't really know how... I see you in here a lot, and I think that you're really pretty, and would you want to go out with me? Ever?
Please go away.
Oh, my God. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
I'm just messing with you. I'm messing with you.
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry.
That's actually pretty mean.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hurt feelings. What's your name?
No big deal. Oh, I'm Andrew.
Andrew.
Yeah.
I'm Nicole.
Nice to meet you, Nicole.
I'm glad you mentioned the character of Nicole. She's played by Melissa Benoist, I believe is how you pronounce it. And she only gets a handful of scenes, but she's really crucial because there isn't really that opposing force in this film for the Miles Teller character. We do see his father played by Paul Reiser, but he's more of ingratiating, supporting. He's not going to be real harsh with his son.
Not at all.
Sense. But she is that polar opposite. She doesn't, as you said, doesn't know what she wants to do and positions that as a worthy way to live your life, to explore and not have everything laid out in front of you and go after it with this driving mm-hmm. force. So I like that she has that role in the film. And you're right about the editing. So crucial to talk about in this picture because we get so many insert shots, I notice, that are not only there to convey information, but the pacing at which they come are like accent beats in a piece of music. And we get them where you'd expect when Andrew joins this elite group and we first see them warming up. So we get the moistening of the reeds, the tuning of the drum keys, yeah. all in these quick insert shots.
There's a real emphasis on procedure.
Very much, here. Very much. But we also get these accent beats in other scenes where you wouldn't expect them. That date scene between the two of them, we'll get a quick one under the table of her foot inching toward his, or even the scene where he goes to the movies with his father, we just get an insert shot of popcorn. And yeah. all that does is give us this sense of fluidity and movement so that this is a movie that's always on the move. And that kind of incorporates this idea of jazz style as well. And I do like how Chazelle and the editor, Tom Cross, incorporate that into the film.
Well, there's a real sense of disorientation throughout the whole movie. And yes, some of it is done with actual kind of camera tricks and a lot of quick pans and tilts. But the music as well, it's a case where there's a lot of jazz playing, and it is New York City, and we've seen a lot of movies that take place in New York City where there's a lot of jazz. You go back to Woody Allen films, though, a lot of them, of course, are movies where he likes to capture New York City in all its majesty and these wide shots and a lot of tracking shots, and we don't get any of that here. This movie is really comprised mainly of close-ups and sometimes even tighter close-ups. And what that does, of course, is it does kind of put you always at sea a little bit as a viewer, and it puts you in the headspace of these characters. But that music in particular, rather than sort of giving you this sense of comfort, I felt like it was the specter just constantly haunting him. I mean, sometimes he is actually listening or watching jazz on YouTube or whatever just because he's so constantly in that space. But even when he's not listening to music, it seems as though the music's following him.
Yeah,
he
pursuing
can't
him,
it.
For sure. And even when we get establishing shots of New York City, they're quick shots cut to the beat of the song that is playing. I do want to ask you, though, how you feel about these formal choices in that climactic scene, which we won't necessarily give away what happens, but it is the big scene at the end, the one that won me over on the movie overall. Yet I did feel like the aesthetic approach that Chazelle was taking throughout the movie by trying to match his visuals with the music almost went a little overboard there. I mean, we get tracking shots, swish pans, widescreen shots of the auditorium. This is a performance we can say is taking place at a jazz competition, I believe. And it was almost, even for jazz, it was almost too much for me.
Yeah, it wasn't for me. I think that might have been, though, that as someone who does love jazz music and who has played in jazz groups since seventh grade, starting out in sort of middle school and high school bands where I didn't really know what jazz was, but then actually discovering bebop and that sort of thing and really appreciating it, playing in different jazz combos. Let's just say that I was really thankful, or at least the audience was really thankful, that when I saw this movie late on a Sunday night, there was no one else in the row with me because I wasn't just tapping my foot. I was I was pounding
well, the music
my
is
leg.
Great. I mean, yeah
I mean, I was
no
I was really into it. So honestly, I might have been so hypnotized by the music and the playing that even though I was aware of some of the pyrotechnics of the camera, it certainly didn't draw me out of it. If anything, it drew me in. That's how caught up in the end of this film I was. Even as I said, I caught myself also thinking about kind of the ramifications of the end of the film. I love about it too, Josh, that I honestly didn't see it coming. You can say
I didn't either.
That,
no.
Well, this is exactly where this type of movie's going, but the movie takes enough little detours that to get to that scene certainly was something I didn't expect.
And that final scene, I think you could describe as having a three-act structure itself.
For sure.
So there's the initial detour, but it takes a few other turns also.
You're listening to Film Spotting. There's a lot more to talk about with this film, Whiplash, Miles Teller's performance, J.K. Simmons. I'm sure you have a few other notes, Josh, but probably a good place to stop for radio. Let's go ahead and keep the conversation going, though, for the podcast, starting with Miles Teller, the star of this film, an actor that you've come to appreciate recently due to his performance in The Spectacular. Now, I've been a little bit on the Teller bandwagon going back to a few earlier performances. What did you think of him here?
Well, what I liked about his performance here is that he goes in a different direction than The Spectacular Now, and one that was very encouraging, because that was a movie which very much in the performance and the character relied on his charm.
Mm-hmm.
And he played that to the hilt. I mean, he just had you, even a kid with major faults, he had you won over instantaneously. He sort of drains himself of that here. And it's maybe not as ingratiating of a performance, but it's a perfect fit for the part and for the movie and for this story that's being told. And again, I was encouraged that he's not concerned with playing somebody who's likable necessarily.
Right.
He was more than willing to go that direction. And you see it in that scene, that date scene again, because The Spectacular Now is a teenage romance in some levels. So it's almost like it could have gone that way. And he really puts the emphasis on the drive that Andrew has and his willingness, especially in the second date scene, to just jettison what he at least thinks might hold him back.
It's funny because whenever an actor plays a performer of some kind, and maybe there's Oscar talk, and I don't know if there's going to be for Miles Teller in this film, but the question comes up, well, are we really awarding or recognizing the performance as an actor or actress, or is it just that we're all so wowed by the fact that, oh, look, Jeff Bridges can play the guitar, or look at how great they sing in this scene. You're almost more wowed by the vocal performance than maybe any of the acting. I don't know whether or not we should give an actor extra credit for that, but maybe we should give Miles Teller some extra credit, Josh, for the drumming, because lots of people can sing pretty darn well. Not very many people, relatively speaking, on this planet can play the drums or even fake playing the drums at this level. And without that ability, and of course he got some lessons, he had some background in it, but he did go through a boot camp that paid off really well. Without his ability and the commitment he shows, this whole movie falls apart. I said that when we were looking ahead to this movie, that you can't fake jazz drumming at this level, and the movie doesn't. I'm sure there are a few tricks at times where it cuts to some of those close-ups. Maybe he's not playing entirely, but there are plenty of scenes where it's entirely clear, there's no way around it, that Miles Teller is playing the drums
in
almost every moment.
You believe it every second.
You believe it every second. Beyond that, though, you're absolutely right that what he brings here is a little bit more of the wounded, vulnerable soul he played in John Cameron Mitchell's Rabbit Hole, though he was much younger then. And he doesn't rely on, you said charm, you can call it charisma, he displayed in The Spectacular Now. I wrote about this on Letterboxd when I shared a few comments about that movie. He has to convince us that he is one of the most popular kids in school, despite the fact that he's not one of the best looking kids probably in school. He's certainly not one of the most well-dressed kids in school, and he's certainly not one of the richest. And those are kind of the three general attributes that can help propel you to winning over any group, especially in high school. He doesn't have any of that. It's just his sheer persona. And I've talked about this a lot, but a movie like Footloose, he's playing that Chris Penn Willard performance. I didn't like that Craig Brewer remake at all, but the one thing I did enjoy watching in that film was the charisma of Miles Teller. Andrew, as you said, has none of that charisma. He is, in some ways, a blank slate beyond this drive.
What does his dad say about him at one point? You have trouble looking people in the eye.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's the opposite of these other characters.
I think he's a character who, if he's not behind the drum set, is instantly forgettable. You wouldn't even be aware that he was in the room unless he was actually playing, again, in sharp contrast to the other characters we've mentioned. More than that, I said that there's a point earlier in the film where he's pretty likable. Of course, as he gets more driven, he becomes more and more unlikable, mm-hmm. downright rude. And that does get back to what I thought was a really interesting point that I singled out from Alex Ross Perry last week talking about Listen Up, Philip. This movie proves it. It's not a genre film per se, like an action movie, though maybe it is if the genre is kind of the inspirational mentor protege movie in some ways. And we've talked about how this movie contradicts some of those cliches. But we forgive narcissistic characters when we want to see them succeed, when they have a clear objective, something they're pursuing. And Andrew does. So even when he's unlikable, we really feel for him
here. We do. And the main reason I think we do is because he has an antagonist. And
good
this
point.
Is Simmons' movie. I mean, the role is built for a big performance. The scenery here has been pre-salted, and the real challenge for Simmons is just not to swallow the thing whole.
Yeah.
I mean, because you could easily go bonkers with a part like this, and I don't think he does. I think he stays true to the mania and the cruelty, the harshness of this character, but he never seems to be doing it outside of the character. And maybe the best way to describe that is a lot of the stuff that he insults his students with is funny. In a way,
yeah.
Cruelly funny.
Sure.
But he never seems to take pleasure in the laugh. So Simmons doesn't pause and let that moment take over the scene because
good point.
He's still angry that kid screwed up. And that's what you see. So I really think you could call this one of those big Oscar-baiting performances. It will get a lot of attention because it's so loud. But I think it's very subtle, too. I mean, think about the scene early on where he takes Andrew aside in the hall and asks him just some personal questions, talks to him in a quiet tone.
Love
and you think,
scene.
Oh, you know, you still think he's probably jerking him around, right? Because we've seen enough now. This can't really be him. But you're wondering, maybe.
Well, maybe he's just jerking him around. This is what I was thinking anyway, in that he's just trying to put him at ease. So even though he is doing something, quote unquote, nice, it's still a form of manipulation.
It's a form of manipulation on two levels.
But
I think you're right.
But then it becomes another form. Yeah.
He's putting him at ease. But then when he gets in there and screws up, he uses some of that information to insult him. And just it's diabolical, really. But even though the roles interchange a bit as the movie goes on, I also don't think we ever get hints of the other side of the Fletcher character, which would be a generic way to do it. You know, show a scene of him at home with his family or something like that. We get a very quick shot of him talking to, you get the sense it's a former co-worker's younger daughter in a nicer voice. But really, this movie is not too concerned with giving Fletcher this other nicer side.
Right.
They're committed to his awfulness, and so is Simmons.
You're right. And maybe there is one bigger scene beyond that scene with the daughter where a little bit of humanity comes out in him. We do learn a little bit later some information that undercuts the humanity of that scene
exactly,
a little bit.
Yeah.
But the performance is absolutely genuine, and there seems to be real emotion under there. And I think that's what's so fascinating is even in the moment and then even thinking about it later, you can't help but think that this emotional scene that he has in front of his band where he seems to let his guard down, he's different than he's been at any other point in the film. You can't help but completely believe it, but then find yourself also saying, but he's probably doing it just because he's been riding them so hard. He's using something that's real,
mm-hmm.
but he is going to exploit it for his own good. And that good is that he can only berate them so much. There has to be that one little break where he shows that to them, even if he doesn't really want to let them in. He has to show them that so they believe that he really cares about them, that all he's doing is really for them. He's hurting them, but it's for their own good. They need moments like that, that he gives them there. And that complexity that J.K. Simmons is playing there in that scene is really something.
Why do you suppose I just hurled a chair at your head, Neiman?
I don't know.
Sure you do.
The tempo?
Were you rushing or were you dragging?
I don't know.
Start counting.
5, 6, 7.
In four, damn it! Look at me!
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Now, was I rushing or was I dragging?
I don't know.
And that brings us back to this idea of perfection, because I don't ever get the sense with the Fletcher character that he's doing any of this to glorify himself as their instructor,
mm-hmm.
or even to win them first place so that he becomes known as this teacher who's won so many contests. He, you believe, is doing it because this is the best way he understands to get them to play as perfectly as they can. And there's something relatable, especially if you have perfectionist streak within you. There's something relatable to that. And so there's a separation between his tactics and his goal.
He's so scary here that I think he's actually scarier than Vern Schillinger, who is the character most of us probably first saw J.K. Simmons on screen in. It was HBO's Oz. And Josh, he's playing there. I don't know if you ever watched Oz. He's playing a neo-Nazi, brutal, murdering rapist.
Okay.
He's,
didn't see Oz, but I can picture it.
He's one of the scariest guys in that entire prison, one that's full of scary characters. And he's actually probably more terrifying here because at least Schillinger has some fun. There is a little bit of a lighter side to him that, as you said, this movie doesn't really give us. There's a moment in this movie, it's like the second time we see the J.K. Simmons character. He walks into another band rehearsal, one that the Andrew character, Miles Teller, is performing in. And just the way he walks into the room, I burst out laughing, actually. I mean, in a very good way. He is such a force.
Yeah.
He has such little regard for anyone else around him that when he walks into this room, it's like a hurricane comes in the room. Everybody stops. It's super loud. Even the instructor, the other instructor, kowtows to him.
It becomes his classroom.
Yeah, and it just becomes his class. And I love that moment. I did think about a lot. You mentioned Full Metal Jacket. That's here. Black Swan, of course, this movie really mirrors closely as well. And the one key difference being in the mentor-protege relationship between Thomas and the Nina character in Black Swan, and what we get here is there's that sexual element psychologically that really wreaks havoc in Black Swan. We don't get that here. But beyond that, there's also some more subtlety to a character like Thomas in Black Swan, because he does have to sort of play a psychological game and insinuate himself to get her to do what he wants her to ultimately do. And we don't ever see that. It's not about suggesting the right way to do something or get at it through your own devices. He's going to compel you to do it the way he wants you to do it.
To get on my tempo.
Yeah, exactly right. And that doesn't mean that, of course, it doesn't still hurt when he compels you that way, but you know at least that he's going to be blatant about it, that he is going to impose his will on you. And I do think it gets back, actually, one of the things I love about this performance is it gets back to this idea of purpose. Everything he does is with a purpose. He knows exactly what he wants in every single moment. He comes into that classroom not to observe, but to find a new player. He comes in, he points him to exactly the bars he wants to go to. That scene where he looks at the score and eyes it for about 3 seconds and then says, cute. You know, he got out of it exactly what he needed to get out of it. And now he's going to have this transaction. And even what he wears, black, the same thing every day. Yes, it's kind of artsy, but it's also simple. He's not going to waste any time picking out his outfit. There's nothing wasted in his body as well. He's a very lean, muscular figure here. There's no extra hair. There's nothing he has to think about to take care of himself except music and driving this band and achieving that level of perfection if he can.
And there's a certain honesty to a character like that as well. I mean, he is diabolical in the information he uses to motivate his players sometimes, but you do know, as you're saying, what his ultimate goal is. And so you know where you stand. It's very black and white. If you can't play to, quote, my tempo, you're out. If you can, you're in. And that's how the landscape is with him.
I said maybe we could get to the topic of perfection and how it relates to jazz. I think maybe we can save it for a little bit of bonus content on another show. That's Whiplash. It is out now in limited release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
When we come back, we'll see how Whiplash's J.K. Simmons fared in our poll about indie movie character actors. Then we'll jump into our list of the best mentor-protege relationships.
Do you want the red pill or the blue pill, Josh?
The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Thank you.
quick interruption here to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM.
One of our listeners, Josh, who shared with us this testimonial, Grace Smith, we use it to host our detective and mystery fiction podcast, Duotang Chesterfield's Mystery Theater. That's duotangmysteries.com, duo, just like it sounds, and Tang, T-A-N-G. This is the first site I've ever made that I really feel proud sending people to. I think it looks great. Duotang Chesterfield's Mystery Theater is a twice-monthly comedic podcast that follows the case files of fictional detectives across the 20th century. Sounds like it's right up your alley, Josh.
I like radio dramas.
There you go.
I'm hooked on Pleasure Town here at BEZ, so maybe I'll give this a try.
Thank you, Grace, for that recommendation, and we will link to that website in our show notes over at filmspotting.net. If you are looking to build a website, maybe for your podcast or whatever artistic endeavor you have, and we hope you are striving for perfection in all of those artistic endeavors.
We accept nothing less.
That's right. You know that Squarespace has easy functionality. Everything is drag and drop, 24/7 support. They have an amazing team in New York City that does live chats during the week and has extremely fast email support throughout the day and night. They're design focused. They really care about that. All their templates are extremely clean, and they have connected accounts, so you can easily bring in Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Pinterest, Instagram, Google, and many more web and social services. The responsive design is key as well. Every Squarespace website has its own unique mobile design. And e-commerce, Josh, Squarespace recently added it to their platform. So if you want to set up a shop and sell things, actually make some money from your artistic endeavor, I know it doesn't usually happen, but if you can, you can do that in just a few minutes. And it all starts at just $8 a month, which includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year.
You can start a Squarespace trial without using a credit card. Just start building your website. Then when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code FILM to get 10% off and to show your support for Film Spotting. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
Do you really think you'll be ready for opening tomorrow?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, well, I mean, previews are pretty much a train wreck. We can't seem to get through a performance without a raging fire or a raging heart on. I'm broke. I'm not sleeping, like, you know, at all. And this play kind of starting to feel like a miniature, deformed version of myself that just keeps following me around and, like, hitting me in the balls with a... like a tiny little hammer. I'm sorry, what was the question?
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh. I'm Adam. Michael Keaton there with Emma Stone in a scene from a film we're planning to review next week on the show, Alejandro González Iñárritu's Birdman. This is a movie, Josh, that has received almost unanimous praise, some ecstatic reviews, in fact. But then there is this opening line from our buddy Scott Tobias over at The Dissolve, frequent guest here on Film Spotting. He says, Alejandro González Iñárritu is a pretentious fraud, but it's taken some time to understand the precise nature of his fraudulence.
Wow. I didn't think we were allowed to use the word pretentious. I did that once
we
a while
do try
ago
to avoid
was,
it.
Was called out on it pretty harshly. So Scott, I don't know, Scott.
Scott can do it. And the fact is, I'm on record as kind of agreeing with him overall about Iñárritu's work, but when I saw him first post on Facebook that he was going to be taking down the tomato meter, taking down the Metacritic rating.
Oh, be careful there.
Yeah, no kidding. You have some experience
there. A little bit.
Give him some advice. I thought, it can't be. This movie just looks too good. It looks too good. We're going to find out.
Yeah, and I have seen it, but I'm not going to say anything because I haven't written anything. I really want to read Scott's review, but I've got to wait. I got to hold off.
That opening line is really all I know, so I'm with you, and we will hold off until we get a chance to discuss it next week on the show. The topic just seemed too rich to keep to ourselves. We decided to invite our old friend Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune to join us. He is going to discuss Birdman with us, and since that show is going to coincide with Halloween, it's going to give us a chance to ask Michael what he'll be dressing up for this Halloween. And if you think I'm joking when I say that, our top five... we had to twist your arm a little bit, Josh, but our top five is movie costumes that we'd wear.
Uh-huh. You know, if Michael shows up as Harpo with one of those horns,
that'd be so beautiful.
I'm not going to be able to take it.
He will probably have a Marx brother as his number one. So we're excited about this list. I think I'm trying to get you excited anyway, Josh, and hopefully our listeners can help in anticipation of this top five. We encourage you to take to the Twitter, to the Facebook, facebook.com/filmspotting. You can find us on Twitter at filmspotting. And what hashtag should we come up with? Hashtag movie costumes?
I guess that would
hashtag
work.
Hashtag movie costumes. Share with us your greatest Halloween triumphs featuring movie-related costumes. Surely our listeners have scads of tattoos.
That's what I was going to say.
Inspired
this
by the movies.
Could be even better
this
than
is
the
much,
tattoo photos.
Much less permanent.
Which you also had to talk me into, by the way.
I did. And, you know, it's still one of my favorite top fives ever. I don't know about you, but use Facebook or Twitter or just email us feedback@filmspotting.net. We will share some of your submissions on the show and over on our Tumblr page. Josh, the Chicago International Film Festival here winding down as we're taping this show, and they've already announced the winners of the Gold and Silver Hugo Awards. And we thought it might be worth, as we did preview this show and have talked about it a little bit, going through a few of these winners and highlighting a couple of them that jumped out to us. The first one being the movie that won the Gold Hugo, the top award as best film, was a movie, I don't know about you, completely off my radar other than when it came out in the SIFF lineup. It's The President, from a director we're familiar with going back to our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon, Mohsen Makhmalbaf. He directed A Moment of Innocence. And also, I'm not crazy, right? The main character in Abbas Kiarostami's Close-Up impersonates Makhmalbaf?
I believe that's correct.
If I'm remembering that marathon correctly. So a key figure in that marathon for us, a wonderful director. And here with his new film, The President, a movie about a dictator who has to face the people he once subjugated. It sounds fascinating. I'm certainly looking forward to it just based on the fact that it's a Makhmalbaf film.
The Silver Hugo Award for Best Actor went to Anton Yelchin, familiar actor here in America, for Rudderless. This was directed by William H. Macy, another one that I had not heard of until we saw it in the lineup. It's about the aftermath of a tragic shooting which takes the life of the teenage son of this grieving father. The father's played by Billy Crudup, and he discovers afterwards the boy's demo tapes. This propels him to form a bond with another young musician played by Yelchin, and together they form a rock band that changes their lives.
And I think the reason this stuck out to me was just the fact that all these films, International Film Festival, Anton Yelchin wins the Silver Hugo for Best Actor. He is a performer I've been fond of in many films, but I don't know if we think of him necessarily as a heavyweight of the screen, Josh, and yet apparently this performance was significant enough to warrant an award of this nature. So that's an interesting one to me that jumped out anyway. The last one we want to highlight goes to the New Directors Competition. The Gold Hugo, the top prize, went to a movie called Underdog from Sweden. But this was really gratifying for us to see, Josh. The Silver Hugo, the runner-up prize, went to a movie from Israel called Next to Her. It's a movie about sisters, this one older sister, I think they're both in their mid-20s, taking care of her mentally disabled sister, and there develops a bit of a love triangle with another boy, and it's really about this relationship and the codependency of it. And this movie, sadly, Josh, a movie that neither of us have caught up with yet, but I do plan to get the DVD screener from the Chicago Film Festival. They do have a copy, and I really want to see it, mainly because not only does it sound like a really interesting film, it played at Cannes this past year, but the director is a filmmaker named Asaf Korman, and we happened to hear from him. Didn't know he was a listener of the show, but he was trying to make it over for the Chicago Film Festival. He had some visa problems, couldn't make it. Unfortunately, he would have been able to accept that Silver Hugo for his movie, but he is a filmmaker in Israel who listens to the show regularly. He sent us this great note.
I don't think I've missed even one episode of Film Spotting during the last year or maybe more. Every time I do the dishes in my small kitchen in Tel Aviv, I take a trip to Chicago with you guys. I listen to the show a lot, going back to old episodes and discussions about my favorite films, and also during the pre-production and shooting of my first feature film, Next to Her, because I found that listening to your conversations reminded me why I love film so much. You take me back to the cinematic sensations I experienced as a child and teenager, to the pure enthusiasm for this endless and magical art form. While working on a film, especially with a very low budget, it's easy to forget that, with all administrative and financial issues in mind. Thanks for that.
Congratulations, and I don't really know how to respond to that. That's incredibly rewarding to read an email like that that did come to us back at the beginning of the festival before his film won an award. But I was really excited to see him get a little bit of acclaim, and we certainly wish him all the best of luck with his future projects. Hopefully he'll get to Chicago at some point, Josh, and maybe we can even have him in studio as a guest on the show. We do also have a quick note about some more movie passes to give away, Josh. We have been giving away a lot of free passes.
We're not done yet.
No, and we are not done. Before I Go to Sleep, it's the new thriller starring Nicole Kidman and Colin Firth. Kidman is a woman who wakes up every day with no memory. This sounds a little bit familiar.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there are tattoos involved or not, but due to a traumatic accident in her past, that is her condition. The movie, again, Before I Go to Sleep, it opens on October 31st, and there's going to be an advanced screening here in Chicago on Wednesday, October 29th. All the information you need about that contest, how you can get those free passes, is available at filmspotting.net.
Actually, it's sort of a stupid job, really. There's nothing interesting about it at all.
What do you do it for, then?
Maybe Frank doesn't like being questioned.
Oh, okay, I know. It's none of my business.
And besides, I know the answer. You want to play house, you got to have a job. You want to play very nice house, very sweet house, then you've got to have a job you don't like. Anyone comes along and says, what do you do it for? He's probably on a 4-hour pass from the state funny farm. All agreed? Ma?
We get into polls with that clip from 2008's Revolutionary Road, a movie directed by Sam Mendes that famously reunited the Titanic stars Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet. I think a lot of people, though, Josh, really remember that movie for Michael Shannon.
Sure.
And his Oscar-nominated performance. A couple weeks back, we were looking ahead to our review of Whiplash and J.K. Simmons. That got us thinking about character actors, actors like Simmons and Shannon, who have been known to upstage some of their better-known peers over the years. Our question simply, your small-budget movie has a part for a character actor in his early 40s/50s. Yes, we did amend that to include the 40s for the young whippersnapper,
yes.
Michael Shannon. Who do you cast in the movie? Your choices, Simmons, John Hawkes, Ben Mendelsohn, Michael Shannon, or the great Jeffrey Wright? How did it come out, Josh?
Packed together here at the end are Jeffrey Wright with 9%, Ben Mendelsohn with 10%. That's followed by J.K. Simmons with 22% up at the top. The two who we voted for, we each won a different way. John Hawkes, 25%. I think that was my pick, right?
It was.
And your pick, Michael Shannon, won 34% of the vote.
Yeah, maybe we swayed our audience too much, or maybe we could have predicted this one before the poll actually did come out. As much as we love, and we know many listeners love actors like Ben Mendelsohn and J.K. Simmons and Jeffrey Wright, there's something about John Hawkes over the years. He struck a chord so many times, so many standout performances in a variety of different roles. And then a guy like Michael Shannon, really, I think Joshua Heiser, one of our recent Masquer Theater winners, says it best in his comments. There is no one better than Shannon. After a week of watching Take Shelter, Shotgun Stories, and Revolutionary Road, I came to the conclusion that he's the best actor of our time. I know that's high praise, but watch those three in a row and tell me otherwise.
Wow. That is high praise.
It's high praise. They are
maybe
all
watching
good performances.
Those in a row will do that to you. We also heard from Jim Pellini in Bethpage, New York. Ben Mendelsohn is a five-tool player. He can physically harm you and your girlfriend, referencing Animal Kingdom. He can put a really bad idea in your head, The Place Beyond the Pines. Pay someone to steal your fingerprints, The Dark Knight Rises. Nod off on heroin as he's revealing information that could result in your assassination.
But we've all done that.
Yes, common. And he can sweat all over you. See all previously mentioned movies. He's the perfect utility man for any studio or indie project.
Well argued and tough to argue with. Connor Sheehy closes us out. I'm choosing Jeffrey Wright for this one, despite the fact that he's probably the biggest gamble on the list. Frankly, Wright has been downright bad in a number of films, particularly when given quirky or jittery roles that bring out tics that probably play much better on stage than on screen. Broken Flowers and Lady in the Water immediately come to mind. But when he's on his game, he's outstanding. His high-stakes, balls-to-the-wall style of acting made him a standout among a cast of top-tier performers in Mike Nichols' incredible adaptation of Angels in America. His dynamic and energetic turn as Jean-Michel Basquiat provided a much-needed human heart for Schnabel's arguably cold and arty biopic, and his recent role in Boardwalk Empire showed off the actor's sinister side to show-stealing effect. All in all, Wright is a wild card, but that makes him all the more exciting and unpredictable as a performer.
All right, so Connor's one of the 9%. Not enough to propel him to the top.
No. Good stuff, though, from Connor, Jim, and Joshua, and all of our listeners. We appreciate all the great comments we get and all the votes we get. Which brings us to this week's poll question. Another good one, I think, Josh, though. Another one I feel like the answer is probably going to be pretty obvious. I think there's going to be a runaway winner.
Well, don't say it.
I won't say it.
We don't want to. Okay.
No. We are looking ahead a couple weeks to our review of Nightcrawler, starring Jake Gyllenhaal. It's the directing debut of screenwriter Dan Gilroy, best known for movies like The Bourne Legacy, Real Steel, and The Fall. If the name Gilroy...
He did Real Steel.
Yeah, Real Steel, I know. You... We're really curious.
Now I'm intrigued.
If the name Gilroy, though, rings a bell, Dan is the brother of Tony Gilroy, also a writer-turned-director best known for penning the original Bourne trilogy and writing and directing Michael Clayton. So, our question, naturally, what's the best screenwriter-turned-director debut? So we're going to give you the movies. You're picking the film, but we will give you the screenwriters and some context here.
So the first film is House of Games from David Mamet. Some of his screenplay efforts were the remake of The Postman Always Rings Twice, Verdict, and The Untouchables. We also have Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, directed by Shane Black of Lethal Weapon fame. The aforementioned Michael Clayton from Tony Gilroy, who did write the Bourne movies. Synecdoche, New York. Charlie Kaufman directorial effort. Of course, he is the screenwriter of Being John Malkovich, Adaptation, and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And one more choice for you here, Searching for Bobby Fischer, which was directed by Steve Zaillian, the screenwriter of Falcon and the Snowman and Awakenings.
So we did consider many others, but a key for us here was looking at these debuts as debuts from screenwriters who were really prominently known as screenwriters. They really had established themselves as Hollywood and as screenwriters, not TV writers. So a lot of people may be thinking about J.J. Abrams in Mission Impossible 3 or Joss Whedon in Serenity, even Frank Darabont, The Shawshank Redemption. But I'm not sure that any of those guys were either established in movies as screenwriters versus TV or had really done enough screenwriting to be thought of in that way.
Sure.
A guy like Frank Darabont really made his name, as I recall, because of The Shawshank Redemption. There are many other choices that we could go with here, and I'm sure we'll get some comments along those lines about who we forgot. Nevertheless, we're sticking with those five: House of Games, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Michael Clayton, Synecdoche, New York, and Searching for Bobby Fischer. Let's go ahead and hold off on our answers. For me, it's a really tough choice between two films on that list.
Okay, yeah.
What about you?
We'll hold off. It's a process of elimination for me. One of these I don't care for. One I've never seen. One, it's been a long time since I've seen it. So it comes down to two for me. Let me think about those two.
All right. You'll find out in a couple of weeks when we find out what you voted for. Do that now at filmspotting.net.
Sand of floor. Sand of floor. Big sucker. Sand of floor. Sand of floor. Yes. Now show me wax on, wax off. Hey.
Wax on, wax off.
Wax on, wax off. Hey, wax on, hat. Wax off.
Pat Morita's Mr. Miyagi with Ralph Macchio's Daniel. What is it, Josh? Daniel San or Daniel Sun?
Oh, you saw that on Twitter.
Of course. Our listeners were going to correct that.
I'm clearly not qualified to answer that question, Adam.
You're not qualified for this entire top five, I'm afraid, just because of that mistake. But that is from The Karate Kid, directed by John G. Avildsen. John G. Avildsen also directed the original Rocky. This dude apparently is the patron saint of mentor-protege movies.
Well, he did Lean on Me, too, so
that's a good,
there you go.
Good point. That's another one that I'm afraid we probably overlooked. Strongly considered Rocky, considered The Karate Kid even, because that was a pretty formative movie for me back in the day, Josh. But
not always a good reason to put it on a top five list.
That's exactly right. Alas, neither of those films going to make our list of the top five mentor-proteges on screen, inspired, of course, by the new movie Whiplash. Hopefully, Josh, you came up with some mentors who aren't quite as terrifying as J.K. Simmons in that movie.
Yeah, although my first choice, you could argue, is pretty scary.
Okay.
Number five, I'm going with Willy Wonka and Charlie from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And by saying that he's scary, you know automatically I'm going with the Gene Wilder version.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Good. I mean, the 1971 original, it's great enough to trump even the affection I have for Tim Burton. I do like his 2005 remake, but
you do.
I do. I like it quite a bit, actually.
Of course you do.
But he and Depp, they're no match for that original take on the Roald Dahl children's book. What we don't know going into this film, unless we've read the book, of course, is that this whole tour of Wonka's candy factory, that the handful of children who have won their golden tickets, the tour that they're going on is really a test. Wonka wants to find an heir to his candy kingdom. And so in a way, you could consider this tour as a crash course mentoring process. He's going to pin down which kid he wants to choose. Now, Charlie, who's played by Peter Ostrom in this version, is clearly the most good-hearted kid of the bunch. I mean, we can all see that right at the beginning. And he does eventually survive this harsh winnowing process that Wonka has devised. There's no such luck for Veruca Salt and the other brats. Now, doing so, Charlie wins not only a lifetime supply of chocolate, but also a ride in the Wonkavator, which is quite something.
It's an elevator.
It's a Wonkavator. An elevator can only go up and down, but the Wonkavator can go sideways and slantways and long ways and back ways and square ways and front ways and any other ways that you can think of. It can take you to any room in the whole factory just by pressing one of these buttons. Any of these buttons. Just press a button and zing! You're off. And up until now, I've pressed them all. Except one. This one. Go ahead, Charlie.
Me?
I remember that Wonkavator scene coming as such a relief when I watched it as a kid. I mean, I was enthralled by Wilder's Wonka for the entire movie, but I was also, as we talked about, scared of him. You know, he was, you never knew what he was going to do or what he was up to. For most of the film, that's my relationship. He was magical, but also mean. But here we finally see what we hope at least is his true side. You're still a little distrustful of him, but he does open up to Charlie. He tells him why he wants to give him the factory. And we get a sense, you know, Wonka's just this candy magnate who has very high standards for his potential protege.
I say good day, sir, and good pick. I do love Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. It's made a few top five lists over the years, that original one, of course. And it's a movie like The Wizard of Oz that back pre-VCR days, yes, we are both old enough to remember, unfortunately, the days before not just DVD, but VHS, that movie coming on TV once a year or whatever, like The Wizard of Oz, and my family sat down and always watched it. Yeah, and when it did come out on VHS, when we got a VHS player, we taped it off TV.
Sure,
of course, watched it repeatedly, so a great pick. I don't have a whole long-winded setup here for once with a top five, Josh. I think the topic does pretty well speak for itself. I'll say that I considered a movie like Zombieland, where you've got a character like Tallahassee, Woody Harrelson, and Columbus and Jesse Eisenberg, where one guy's clearly older and wiser and he does teach him a few things, but I didn't ever get the sense that Eisenberg is ever trying to be like him, really, or even really learning the ropes from him. He already has his survival rule. So I really was focused on, more than anything, the relationship. I wasn't trying to pick the coolest mentor and protégés or the ones that I think are just the overall best characters, but it had to be fundamentally about that relationship. Of course, have to throw out the disclaimer that a movie like Star Wars, the original, Obi-Wan and Luke, Yoda and Luke from The Empire Strikes Back, both those movies, but just those two, Josh.
I might have found a workaround.
Yeah, you may have found a workaround. Just those two are in the film spotting pantheon. They are forbidden for this list. And penalty box, I've only got one movie. Everybody knows it's coming. I can't put Lester Bangs and William Miller on this list as much as I'd like.
I was actually really hoping you wouldn't.
No, yeah, not going to. Almost Famous is maybe forever in the perpetual penalty box. And there is one director I just threw out completely. I said I can't touch this director's films. I have a feeling he may come up later, so I'll just leave it at that and get to my number five. I said that I left out Rocky. That doesn't mean I couldn't find room for a pretty good sports movie. And that movie is Bull Durham. The mentor, Crash Davis, Kevin Costner, and Tim Robbins, Nuke Lelouch. There are mentors, I think we'll get to some on our list, who know their mentors. They start the movie as coaches or teachers or whatever, and there maybe was a process that got them to that point that we don't necessarily see. Crash Davis never fully embraces his role as mentor, even as he is really successful at it. He's a minor league player, been around for a lot of years, and he still thinks he's got some good baseball left in him. He's still hanging on to this dream that he might make it back to the show someday. Turns out the organization just wants him to bring along this wild young pitcher. Nuke, there are a lot of quotable, hilarious scenes for me in this movie. I don't know about you, Josh, if you've even seen it, because it is an 80s movie and it is a baseball movie.
Baseball.
Which never did anything for you somehow, but all my favorite scenes in Bull Durham involve Crash trying to teach Nuke something, talking to him about cliches and winning streaks and how strikeouts are fascist and how not to shake him off when he tells him what pitch to throw. My favorite, though, is on the bus. Nuke challenges him. He says, what do you know, like you've ever played in the majors?
Yeah, I've been in the majors.
You've been in the show, man?
Yeah, I was in the show. I was in the show for 21 days once.
Wow.
21 greatest days of my life.
Bet.
You know, you never handle your luggage in a show. Somebody else carries your bags. It's great. You hit white balls for batting practice. Ballparks are like cathedrals. The hotels all have room service. The women all have long legs and brains.
Something about that line, even as a kid, always stuck out to me. He describes the women as all having long legs and brains. It just stuck out because you've got a bus full of testosterone-filled athletes, and yet when he tries to describe how quote-unquote hot the women are in the show, he describes them as having long legs and brains. That shows you that he's just on a little bit more of a cerebral level than the rest of them. But he uses that whole exchange as a teachable moment. He brings it back to Nuke and tries to reinforce what he needs to do to get to the show someday if he just get his head on straight.
No, Bull Durham, it's good stuff. You're not going to pigeonhole me there. Yes,
okay,
yes.
I'll take that.
And you know, sometimes the reluctant mentors, they can be the best, right? So, yeah, that's a good way to describe him. My number four is Gusteau and Remy from Ratatouille. Now, admittedly, the mentor-protege relationship mostly takes place in one character's imagination here, but it still leads to practical results, so I think it fits. Remy is, of course, the hero of Pixar's 2007 triumph about a rat who dreams of becoming a world-famous French chef, which I believe this was one of Michael Phillips' top five of the film spotting era, right?
I thought you were going to say based on a true story, which would have been
no,
more interesting.
Not that I've heard.
Michael Phillips had it very high.
He does love this movie, as do I. Gusteau is Remy's role model, and this is largely because he's been watching his cooking show. The chef's has died by the time the movie starts, but Remy's still been watching his cooking show, devouring his cookbooks. And I think that it's still a very effective relationship for the film because the director and co-writer here, Brad Bird, he sells us on this whole unlikely concept of a rat chef, in large part by making us fully believe in Remy's dream. And part of the reason we do so is because of the couple of scenes we get where an imaginary Gusteau gives Remy advice. And it's all rooted in this motto that Gusteau has that his cookbooks follow and his show did. Anyone can cook.
Well, yeah, anyone can. That doesn't mean that anyone should.
Well, that is not stopping him. See?
What is he doing? No. No! No, this is terrible! He's ruining the soup! And nobody's noticing it! It's your restaurant! Do something!
What can I do? I am a figment of your imagination.
But he's ruining the soup!
Remy is voiced by Patton Oswalt, and Gusteau is voiced by Brad Garrett of Everybody Loves Raymond, and they bring a real mentor-protege dynamic to their brief scenes together. Gusteau, he's gently guiding Remy's talent, and he also has little moments where he deflates his pompousness, because this rat is a food snob, too. It's one of the delightful things about him. And the more I think about Ratatouille, actually, I think probably Oswalt's Remy is my favorite vocal Pixar performance. I don't know. Maybe I'll wait till we do that top five list to nail it down for sure. But yeah, watching clips of this again, it's just so crucial to that character. And these scenes with Garrett as Gusteau, they're so good.
Well, I do not appreciate that film as much as you and Michael. Hard to appreciate it as much as Michael does, but it's one I'm in badly need of revisiting. My number four is based on a true story, Josh. Late 1970s, an undercover FBI agent who infiltrates a notorious New York City crime family, the movie Donnie Brasco. The mentor and protege, of course, are Lefty Ruggiero, played by Al Pacino, and Donnie, played by Johnny Depp. This is another idea we've seen play out in different forms, in different types of movies several times. Somebody goes undercover, they develop some attachments, and things get messy. There may be a romantic involvement, or the group's principles actually start to take on meaning for the individual who's trying to bring them down. What it is here, the messiness here, is this incredibly close relationship between these two men. Donnie is sort of an apprentice just based on Lefty being the one who vouches for him, who brings him into this mob world and teaches him the ins and outs. But as their friendship grows, he does start to see Donnie as sort of a son, not the drug addict disappointing son he really has, but someone he can groom to not just follow in his footsteps, but maybe surpass him. And, you know, there's that old cliche about parents always wanting their kids to have better than they had, to end up doing better. He's constantly, the Lefty character, getting passed over for things. He's just respected enough to stay in the life, but he's not a success by any real definition, certainly not within this world. And he does start to see Donnie as his legacy. And going back to Whiplash, it gives him some purpose to kind of bring Donnie along. And Donnie sympathizes with him and sees something pitiful in Lefty, but also something noble, even if it's just that he understands his standing in the world. I love Pacino's performance in this movie, and I especially love it when he talks about being a spoke on the wheel. He recognizes that that's all he is in this world. And those conflicted feelings that Donnie has for Lefty and that Lefty has for Donnie, even as there are signs that something could be amiss, that he might be a rat, that's what drives this film. And I think really, for me, what elevates it above your standard undercover cop fare.
How many times I have you into my own house?
Twice a week at least.
Yeah, there it is, at least. I cook for you.
Yeah?
If ever I had any money, I'd give you. I never had any money. But if ever I had $100 in my pocket, I'd give you 50, right?
Yeah, you did.
If you're a rat, then I'm the biggest mutt in the history of the mafia.
Even if this thing is a federal boat left. They scam all these other people. They didn't scam us. You know what I'm saying?
Do you think we'll get another performance from Depp like the one he gives in Donnie Brasco? I mean, it's been a long time now. It probably...
He wasn't all done up in a costume.
Well, yeah,
or...
I mean, really, 2009's Public Enemies is probably, you know, not nearly the performance, but that sort of role, at least. Otherwise,
where he's recognizable.
There really hasn't been anything in 10 years.
That's a good point.
It would be good to see.
Rewatching some scenes from it today and watching some of it just... month or so ago, it was on HBO one night, flipping channels, trying to go to bed, end up on it, instantly sucked in, and instantly sucked in watching that friendship play out and watching that mentor-protege relationship play out.
We'll be back with picks 3 through 1 for the best mentor-protege relationships in a bit. Don't worry, if I go with Yoda, Adam, I'll spare you a voice impression, especially after that disastrous attempt at the 500 Live show. Stay with us.
Josh, if there are listeners out there who can't tell that the tunes we've featured in our two music breaks are the same tunes, then either they're trying to sabotage our podcast or they don't know which is worse. Only people who've seen Whiplash will get that joke, but I had to make it.
It's worth it.
Because we are featuring the same tune. The song, as our jazz aficionados out there will know, is So What? And this maybe has been one of the biggest challenges I've had in recent weeks here on the show, maybe recent months, because I knew we had this show devoted to jazz drumming and Whiplash. I had to pick from all my favorites, and the jazz drummer is always who I'm focused on in any combo. I had to pick from all those songs and all those performers which two songs I was going
to
feature.
You didn't want to just go with the two that are featured so prominently in the film, Caravan and Whiplash?
Well, I mean, if I wanted to go
too
easy.
Too obvious.
Too obvious indeed. I had to personalize it a little bit. So in the first break, we heard the Herbie Hancock Quintet. Josh, Herbie Hancock, want to throw out which college he went to? Got a guess?
No, I have no idea.
Grinnell College. Okay. Thank you, Herbie Hancock. That was from the Tribute to Miles CD, and that's the first tune with the drummer, Tony Williams. Started with Miles Davis when he was 17 years old. He is my favorite jazz drummer. And really, that for me, the reason I wanted to play it is that's the song that within about 10 seconds had me hooked on jazz. Up to that point, I had played in jazz bands, but it was really just another high school or junior high thing. It really wasn't something I cared about. Heard that song, instantly went back through the Miles archive and started to really kind of learn about jazz music because of So What. And then here I am trying to pick one other song to feature on the show. And what do? I decide to be really boring and redundant and pick the same tune. But So What from 1959's Kind of Blue, obviously a completely different approach to the song, the original approach from Miles Davis. So there you go, a seminal jazz piece and then redone by those guys who, all except for the trumpet player Wallace Roney, played famously with Miles.
Now, are you going to wake up in the middle of the night regretting these choices? Is this something you can move on from?
I don't know.
Do you feel good about it?
I mean,
just have to wait and see.
Max Roach, Elvin Jones, Art Blakey. That's all they're going to get is just a mention.
Our listeners
don't get to hear. But the reason I picked it, I forgot. It would have worked out perfectly had this guy played on Kind of Blue, played on that track So What. But he was Miles' regular drummer throughout most of the 1950s up until Kind of Blue, right up until 1958. A drummer who you had maybe never heard of until Whiplash, Philly Joe Jones.
I had not.
Plays a key role via a story that J.K. Simmons' instructor tells as a real lesson in terms of his philosophy on teaching.
You're just like a Massacre Theater emailer here with all these connections. It's amazing.
Well, let's move on to some donations and thank yous. We just have a few of them this week, but want to thank Jason K. here in Chicago for his gold level donation, Mark in Dallas, Texas for being a new $5 a month subscriber, and we have a new Silver Club donation, Josh, from Kylie Swanson. She's in Oklahoma. She sent us a postcard, went to our P.O. box, and she has a birthday note for one of our biggest fans, her boyfriend, Sam Calvin.
Kylie says, when he's not with me, and sometimes when he is, he's listening to you all. You keep him company on his drives to and from work and even help him fall asleep at night. I thought the best gift I could give him would be to donate to you on his behalf. Thank you for the hours of enjoyment you've given both of us. P.S. Please let your listeners know that although a great movie, The Piano Teacher is not the greatest movie for date night.
Fair to say. I don't think you're going to get much argument there, that Michael Haneke film, but we appreciate the advice and say thank you and happy birthday to Sam. I also say I'm sorry because, as I've lamented on the show in the past, sometimes things get bottled up at the film spotting P.O. box.
Uh-huh.
I'm a very busy man, Josh. Sometimes I can't make it to the post office during hours.
You're dithering over what jazz tune to select.
How dare you?
Can't get to more important things.
How dare you? But I made it. Unfortunately, a little bit too late. I'm guessing we missed Sam's birthday by at least a few weeks. It's October 20th as we sit and tape the show, and that postcard was dated September 20th.
Yikes.
So she gave us her hard-earned money.
Uh-huh.
Also, we'd say thank you.
Tied to a specific event.
Right.
And
she's just
time.
Been waiting in agony every show, hoping Sam would hear this, and instead what he has to hear is me apologizing.
This is terrible, and it's something of a trend. I mean, I like that we've gotten a few of these now, birthday donations in honor of someone, but I believe at least two of them have also been belatedly acknowledged on the show.
You got to plan in advance for my delinquency.
Or
send it a month early.
Station an intern at the P.O. box. Can we do that?
I'll get right on that.
Thank you.
This is Craig Brewer, the director of Black Snake Moan, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Inspired by the new film Whiplash, our top five this week is Mentor, Proteges, Josh, my number five pick, Bull Durham, Crash Davis teaching Nuke Lelouch, and my number four, Donnie Brasco, Lefty Ruggiero, played by Al Pacino with Johnny Depp's Donnie.
At number five, I had Willy Wonka and Charlie. That would be from the 1971 film version. And my number four was Gusteau and Remy from Ratatouille.
Radio listeners, if you want to hear our takes on those picks, you can find the full version of the show, which usually runs about 90 minutes versus the 55-minute version here on WBEZ. You can find it at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. That brings us to our top three, Josh. What is your number three?
Enough with the kids' stuff. I'll move on to more adult material, and we get that from Paul Thomas Anderson quite frequently, so I'm going with Sidney and John from Heart 8. This is Anderson's 1996 debut. It's also known by the title as Sidney, and it's a character portrait of a mentor. Philip Baker Hall Sidney, who's an older gambler. He's working the system in Reno and Vegas. When Sidney comes across a distraught card player named John, and this is John C. Reilly, he takes him under his wing and shows him the casino ropes.
If I were to give you $50, what would you do with it?
I'd eat.
How long can you eat? How long can you live on $50?
I don't know.
I would bet not very long.
You would bet.
I tell you what. You come with me back to Vegas. I'll loan you $50. I'll show you what you did wrong.
There's a lot more to their relationship, but seen as this is probably Anderson's least seen film, I don't want to give any of the narrative developments away. I will say, though, that some of the most pleasurable moments in the film are early on when Sidney is tutoring John in certain tricks, like how to play the rate cards against the cashiers or something like that. I was never quite sure how that worked, you know, math and stuff. But the delight in those scenes, it's just seeing Sidney's smooth tutelage and John's almost giddy delight as he's learning this stuff. Philip Baker Hall gives Sidney a matter-of-fact, unruffled demeanor that's really the epitome of cool. In fact, Samuel Jackson, who plays this casino security supervisor, he calls Sidney Mr. Cool, Mr. Wisdom. And there's another name that Sidney is given by Gwyneth Paltrow's cocktail waitress. She calls him Captain. And all of these titles signify, they speak to his air of authority, and Captain especially to the way he relates to John as his mentor. I'm going to try to make it through all of Anderson's stuff before we get a chance to see Inherent Vice, which will probably be maybe in a month. So it was nice that this paired up here with our mentor-protege relationships list. I could watch Hard Eight again. But boy, that's going to be tough. The last time I did this was Wes Anderson. His films are a lot shorter.
That's true. I love the Sidney and John characters and that relationship. I love the movie Hard Eight. P.T. Anderson is the director I just had to completely write off for this list. I talk all the time about his movies and how so many of them feature that father-son dynamic. Mm-hmm. That, of course, can translate into mentor-protege type relationships. The Master, There Will Be Blood, Hard Eight, Boogie Nights with, of course, Jack and Dirk Diggler. So that's definitely a dominant theme in P.T. Anderson's work, and I love all of those movies. Well, you said you didn't have any more kid stuff. My number three is going to take us back to kid stuff of sorts. The movie's Paper Moon, and the mentor and protege are Moses Prey, played by Ryan O'Neal, and Addie Loggins, played by his daughter Tatum O'Neal. Yes, she famously and still stands as the youngest Oscar winner ever. She won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress at age 10. And we go from my number four pick, where we had in Lefty and Donnie a pseudo father-son relationship, to an actual father-daughter relationship off-screen, and maybe one on. We never completely find out in this Peter Bogdanovich movie from 1973 whether Moses truly is Addie's father or not. They meet at a funeral for Addie's mother. He once had a relationship with her and meets her there, denies being her father, but some of the townspeople suggest that maybe he is, and he agrees reluctantly, another reluctant mentor, to deliver her to her aunt's house in Missouri, there in Kansas. I do love, Josh, how Addie says at one point he probably is her father because she has his jaw, which of course she does because she's Tatum O'Neal and he's Ryan O'Neal, and that makes perfect sense. She at one point watches him use her to make some money and decides that she wants in on his con. And his usual con is he preys on widows who pay him the balance owed. He suggests that their husband, before they passed, bought a Bible. And now, you know what, they put down a deposit, they just owe a little bit more money, and he's usually able to get it out of them, and they end up working together to do that, as she wants to make a little money for herself.
What company you say you're from?
The Kansas Bible Company, out of Wichita.
Kansas Bible Company? I ain't never heard of no Kansas Bible Company.
Daddy, can't we go now? I want to get to church and pray for Mama.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sure we can, honey. Daddy was just fixing the lead. This here is my little girl. It's just the two of us now.
My mama's gone to the Lord.
Oh, so is poor Mr. Bates, honey. I'll just give you back his dollar deposit, and you let us know if there's anything we can do.
Hold on there. Wait one damn minute. He actually done ordered a Bible, huh?
He sure did. Here it is, right here in gold, for somebody named Marie.
That's her. She's Marie.
Oh, she sure did mean a lot to him. He especially had me get the deluxe edition.
How much to keep this here book?
Oh, well, that one is the...
It's a $12 one, Daddy.
$12?
$12.
This is a movie I hadn't seen, Josh, until I watched it, I think back in 2008 it was, in preparation for my second interview with Rian Johnson. We were talking about The Brothers Bloom, a Cannes movie, and this movie was hugely influential for him. He wrote at the time of Paper Moon, "I love plenty of movies, but this is the only one that I can honestly say I wish I had made. It's a few things at once, a road movie, a father-daughter story, and a con man movie, but the real miracle of Paper Moon is, for me, its resonance by way of anachronism. Like Harry Nilsson, Bogdanovich created something singular and honest largely by just plain ignoring the past 30 years. Style-wise, it eschews any new Hollywood naturalism and reaches for the rafters. It is in black and white. The dialogue snaps with unabashed vaudevillian bravado. The performances are theatrical to match, and the photography could be out of a Max Sennett one-reeler. And with all of these elements that to a modern sensibility might seem like the definition of emotional straight-arming, Paper Moon works perfectly on every single level and feels as emotionally resonant and true as anything to come out of the 70s. Just perfect." That's high praise, and also contradicts what I said during our Whiplash discussion that art can't be perfect.
That perfection's possible.
Rian says that it is, and he's dead on with his take in Paper Moon. I don't know if I quite love it as much as Rian does, but I really love the movie, and it's because it's so emotionally resonant, but also just entertaining watching them work those cons together.
Have you seen a lot of Bogdanovich films?
I haven't.
Because I have.
Last Picture Show?
Honestly,
that might be
I
it.
Think the only one I've seen, oddly, is Mask from the mid-80s.
Well, I saw Mask several times in the 80s.
Yeah, so I'm thinking, you know, add him to that ever-growing marathon.
Though
list,
he's only
possibly.
Really directed, I'm going to show my ignorance here, hadn't he only made about six feature films, five or six? And I think maybe more recently he's made a few, but there's not a ton of movies in his filmography.
I think there's enough. There would be enough for a marathon. How great they all are is maybe the question, but he could also be a figure where you come across some sort of underrated gems, possibly. Mm-hmm. Maybe down the road, we'll see. All right, my number two is my Star Wars cheat here. It is The Emperor and Darth Vader in Star Wars Episode 6, Return of the Jedi. I recently revisited this as part of my family indoctrination project before the new Star Wars films come out, showing those to the kids for the first time. It's going pretty well, I think. They're not crazy about them, but the older daughter is going to be Darth Vader for Halloween, so I think that says something. I think they're burrowing in there somehow.
You know, real quick, I should interject that my family wanted to go with the Star Wars theme this year for Halloween as well.
Oh, yeah?
But ruining it was the 4-year-old Connor, who just refuses to play Yoda.
And he can't. Well, he has the stature.
He has the perfect stature.
But he
for
carries
Yoda.
That much weight in the family.
No.
If he says no, it's off.
It ruins everything. Unfortunately, Connor has no imagination. He wants to be a blue ghost.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. Well, it's not Yoda.
No, it's not. All right. Return of the Jedi is probably the installment from my childhood that has fallen the most in my esteem rewatching it now. I still do like it quite a bit. And what did elevate it, or at least hold it up for me this time, is that climactic three-way showdown among the Emperor, Darth Vader, and Luke Skywalker, in which we see the truly villainous endgame that the Emperor is up to. To recruit Luke to become his new protege at the expense of Vader, Luke's own father.
What is the Emperor after, Josh? What is
that,
he seeking?
He just wants
no,
Luke.
No, what's that P word? That P word that you perform so
well. No, I'm not
so
doing
well.
That again. That,
really?
That was only for our live audience.
It. They're demanding it out there.
You can't spring that on me. You know the preparation that took? There is that moment, though, when the Emperor is electrocuting Luke and Vader stands there looking back and forth. We can see the wheels turning, even though, you know, they're hidden behind the mask. That always struck me as just this beautifully distilled, dramatic moment. And then once Vader makes the choice and he tosses the Emperor over the railing, getting electrocuted in the process, we get this brief shiver of Vader's skeleton. I mean, that's pure pop poetry right there. So, yes, A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, they're both in the pantheon. No Yoda. That would be the obvious choice to go with. But I do think this mentor-protege relationship between the Emperor and Vader, it's just as rich, especially in the context of the narrative trajectory of all the six films we now have. So we see Vader as the central figure, chooses the wrong mentor, and at the eventual cost of his life.
Good pick. Can't argue with it. And no, it's not a cheat. Return didn't get anointed into the pantheon. Not
should,
yet, anyway.
Should we put it in there at some point, or is it just not good enough for
it's
the pantheon?
It's not up to snuff with those
okay.
other two.
No, I'd agree with that.
Okay. My number two film, I'll give you a quote to see if you can get it, Josh, see if our listeners can identify it. "I'm not your daddy. I'm not your boyfriend, so don't be playing games with me. I'm your partner." And if that doesn't help, this one will, even if you haven't seen the movie. Pool Excellence is not about excellent pool. Yes, it's a movie that I seem to adore much more than the rest of the world, even though I look today, and much to my surprise, has a 92% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's pretty high.
It's The Color of Money. Fast Eddie Felsen, played by Paul Newman, and Vince, played by Tom Cruise. Everybody compares it to The Hustler and says it's not as good as The Hustler. And then everyone compares it to other Martin Scorsese films and says it doesn't
quite match
up. It has
stiff competition if you're going to do that.
And it really does. There are, shamefully, still a fair number of Martin Scorsese movies I need to see. But as of right now, I've got The Color of Money in my top six or seven. Yet again, another reluctant mentor, Fast Eddie, takes Vince under his wing really because he's doing it as a good bet. He thinks if he can teach him how to hustle the right way, he's got the raw talent as a pool player. Now if he can teach him how to be a hustler, they'll both make some money. I love his line at one point. He says to Vince's girlfriend, Mary Elizabeth Master Antonio, "We've got a racehorse here, a thoroughbred. You make him feel good. I teach him how to run." How this relationship between the student and teacher is a little bit different than some of my other picks is this isn't a case where being a mentor further cements for Eddie that role. It's not something where he takes to it and decides, yeah, this is something for me. I'm going to stay out of the game, out of the pool game. I'll keep in the whiskey business. Maybe I'll bring a few more guys like Vince along and make some more money. What it does, seeing Vince and not being able to really break him, just stokes his competitive fire. It reinvigorates him to the point where by the end of the film, he's going on without Vincent to play pool. And Newman, like this movie, gets slagged a little bit for winning the Oscar for this performance, which isn't really fair, but they're basing it on all these other great performances he didn't win for and saying it was kind of a lifetime achievement award. I will put his turn as Fast Eddie up against any of his other performances. He is interesting in every moment and honest in every moment, every second he's on screen. Every movement, every word, every sentence. As a viewer, I'm watching him like he's my teacher. I'm watching him thinking, how can I be like this guy? I want to have that kind of gravitas. I want to have that kind of understanding of human nature. It's all in Newman's performance.
You walk into a pool room with that go-go-go, the guys will be killing each other trying to get to you. You got that. But I'll tell you something, kiddo. You couldn't find big time if you had a road map. Pool excellence is not about excellent pool. It's about becoming someone.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Like what?
Student. You gotta be a student of human moves. See, all the greats that I know of to a man were students of human moves.
Students of human moves?
Yeah. That's my area of excellence.
All right, I don't rate it quite as highly as you do either, but I'm more than willing to give it a revisit. I'd love to do that. Brings us to number one, and my film is Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. It was hard to choose, though, the relationship in Ang Lee's 2000 international blockbuster, because it charts the pursuit in one way of a mentor-protege relationship. It also charts the dissolving of another. For the purpose of this list, I think I'm going to focus on Lee Mu Bai and Ren Yu. Chow Yun-fat plays Lee Mu Bai, and he's a martial arts master who's about to give up his warrior life when his sword is stolen. He tracks down the mysterious thief who turns out to be the rebellious daughter of an aristocrat who's under the influence of a notorious villainess known as Jade Fox. So this daughter is Ren Yu, played by Zhang Ziyi, and she's starting to pull away from Jade Fox. So the film becomes something of a tug of war between these different factions for Ren Yu's heart. Of course, it's not the plot we remember from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon as much as all these contemplative visuals. The movie has this very meditative lull, even during the fight scenes. And what I liked about it for this list is that the mentor-protege tug of war that's going on does play out in the actual physicality of the fight scenes. This is particularly the case and probably why I chose their relationship in the showdown between Ren Yu and Lee Mu Bai when they're in the bamboo forest, really the most famous scene from the film, I think. He tries to convince her during this to become his student. And as they're doing this, the treetops are bending and swaying, just as her allegiances do throughout the film. Crouching Tiger is not a picture I've seen since its release, but wow, I really want to watch it again after just seeing some of these showdowns today, and also made me excited for next year's anticipated sequel. Different director, so who knows where it'll go, but still what a fun film Crouching Tiger was.
I'm with you. I haven't seen it since it came out. I loved it, though, when it came out. I believe it was 2001. And because I haven't seen it in so long, that was really why I kept it off my list. Strongly considered it. It was in my top five at one point. And you make a really compelling case, but I think why I ultimately left it out, and maybe this is just my ignorance of the movie since it's been so long, is I felt as if even though those mentor-protege relationships were so crucial to the film, we don't see him really in a mentoring role ever. We know that he had that role previously, but he's not anymore. And then until kind of that scene where he tries to get her.
Yeah, that's the most direct moment for sure.
And we don't really ever see Jade Fox teaching her as much as maybe I thought for this top five. Anyway.
Yeah, but their relationship is crucial at the start to one of the keys why Ren Yu pulls away is because Jade Fox sees, and this goes back to Donnie Brasco a little bit, sees that the younger protege is surpassing her in
right.
skill. And so that sort of kicks off this rift. So it's maybe harder to pin down a specific relationship in this film, but in some ways it's what the film's all about.
It is. And Greg Bolton, a listener in Columbus, Georgia, just wrote us earlier today and said that he would suggest the pair of Ren Yu and Jade Fox from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, although Chow Yun-Fat's Master Li and Michelle Yeoh's Yu Shulin also take turns as the potential mentor for Zhang Ziyi's talented protege martial artist. The entire movie is almost a meditation upon mentorship. Jade Fox, the villain of the film, was herself the product of a mentor who refused to take her seriously.
So, there you go.
Yeah, I'm with Greg and Josh. You guys have convinced me. My number one film, Josh, it's been over a year and a half since we last anointed a movie into the film spotting pantheon. It was April 2013. We had a trifecta of movies. Mulholland Drive from David Lynch, Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, and a little movie by Francis Ford Coppola called Apocalypse Now.
Oh, that's in the pantheon?
It's in the pantheon, despite the fact that on our top five movie Narcissus last week, I decided to employ some kind of loophole that I didn't know existed and put Colonel Kurtz as my number four.
Well, what happens now? Do you have to redo this list?
I may have to
There are serious repercussions, aren't there?
What is the punishment for that? I'm not sure. Apocalypse Now may have to come out of the pantheon or something. And in fact, earlier today on Twitter, someone said, how could Apocalypse Now not be in the pantheon? Well, rest assured, it is. And I texted Sam, even our producer, as soon as I made that pick, right before taping the show, I thought of it. I was like, what a brilliant pick.
Mm-hmm.
Texted Sam, man, our pantheon, what a joke. How could Apocalypse Now not be in it?
And there it is.
But we're getting off topic.
You got caught up. It's not in alphabetical order.
That's it.
That's
now
tripped
been
me up
redone.
A few times, too.
It's
oh, has
been
it?
Redone in alphabetical order.
We'll never make a mistake again.
The dearth of films in the pantheon, at least recently, that's changing here with my number one because of the mentor-protege relationship at the core of The Red Shoes. Boris Lermontov and Vicky Page, of course, played by Maura Shearer, and the great, great Anton Walbrook. This is a movie that has made numerous top five since first winning the Archer Award for Best Picture in our 2010 Powell Pressburger Marathon. And I'm going to quote Roger Ebert here. He says about the movie, my notion is that Lermontov is Mephistopheles. He has made a bargain with Vicky. I will make you the greatest dancer the world has ever known. But he warns her, a dancer who relies upon the doubtful comforts of human love will never be a great dancer. Never. We see this in Whiplash, right? We see Andrew Miles Teller say goodbye to his girlfriend, say we can't see each other. He makes the same choice Vicky makes in this movie with Julian, who she loves a lot. Like the Satan, Ebert says of classical legend, he is enraged when he wins her soul only to lose it again. He demands obedience above all else. And he is a pretty demanding ruler, not maybe quite as physically imposing, certainly not as J.K. Simmons in Whiplash, but he is nevertheless a force. It's on this list because I adore this movie. I adore these characters, but it really is the perfect culmination of the show that started with Miles Teller and J.K. Simmons. Really, Teller allowing Simmons to destroy him in that quest for artistic greatness.
Vicky. Vicky. Little Vicky. There it is, all waiting. Sorrow will pass, believe me. Life is so unimportant. And from now onwards, you will dance like nobody ever before.
With that scene and that pick, The Red Shoes going into the film spotting pantheon.
Thank you.
I concur with the anointing movie I love as well. I've had it on a couple lists. Moira Shearer was one of my top five movie redheads. And the other one was pretty recently, actually. Oh, magical realism moments. So,
yeah,
it deserves to be in the pantheon. Now, let's just remember it's in there.
Yeah, let's try. Scenes on a Stage was a top five we considered for next week with Birdman.
Yeah.
And I remember you throwing out in those conversations The Red Shoes. And it occurred to me that The Red Shoes is such a great film and in some ways so all-encompassing of cinema that The Red Shoes could probably make every top five.
Every top five,
we've
right.
ever done.
There are
it just
movies
seems
like that.
Somehow appropriate for every list. And it's those types of films that do belong in the pantheon. And there it is now, forever bestowed. Those are our top five mentor proteges. Josh, did you have any honorable mentions?
I did have a couple honorable mentions. We referenced Morpheus and Neo from The Matrix, could have gone with them. I'm ignoring Wes Anderson for a while. Otherwise, I would have gone with Max Fisher and Herman Bloom from Rushmore. And not film, but one of my favorite relationships of this type, Don Draper and Peggy Olson in Mad Men. That's really what that show is all about for me. And I do want to mention a couple regrets I had because these were great suggestions from the Film Spotting Advisory Board.
Yeah.
And I just didn't have time to get to them. Melissa Taminga suggested My Fair Lady. Martin Teller suggested Akira Kurosawa's Red Beard. Both of those, about 3 hours long, I just wasn't able to squeeze either of those in before taping.
Well, I'll go with a Kurosawa film that was also mentioned in our forum, Stray Dog, the detectives in that movie. How about Clueless? Cher, Alicia Silverstone, and Ty. I do like the movie Clueless. Jim Malone and Elliot Ness in The Untouchables. Kevin Costner there with Sean Connery. We did mention Rocky, and this is something, this dynamic we see from Oliver Stone quite a bit. Sergeants Barnes and Elias with Chris Taylor, Charlie Sheen in Platoon, but also Wall Street, Gordon Gekko and Bud Fox. I suppose I also have to mention Tyler Durden and the narrator in Fight Club, Morpheus and Neo, as you did in The Matrix. And how about another movie that isn't in the Film Spotting pantheon and truly does reveal it to be the fraud that it just may be? Sheriff John T. Chance in Colorado from Howard Hawks' Rio Bravo.
How about the fact that I haven't seen Rio Bravo?
What?
I just wanted to see your face. Can't go in the pantheon until I've seen it. So you okay there? You all right?
I mean, you know, I really have no room to talk here because without a Film Spotting marathon in 2005, it was our first ever marathon.
See, I wasn't doing
Rio
those
Bravo
then.
And westerns. The fact that Sam and I had not seen hardly any westerns.
See,
was
so
the
I'm
reason
only, I'm only 10 years behind
it's
you.
It's the reason we started the marathons. Yeah, I had a little bit of a head start, I guess. Wow, that's a bombshell. We'll just have to let it
I hope
there.
You recover.
Those are our picks. If you have any thoughts about the show or want to send us your picks or just ridicule Josh for not having seen Rio Bravo,
that'll come.
Do it. Feedback
at Filmspotting. Because everyone else has seen every
that's
movie
right.
that's
every
ever
movie.
Been made.
Feedback at filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter at Filmspotting and at Facebook.com/Filmspotting.
Out in wide release this week, I think I'm back. Keanu Reeves as John Wick.
Neo.
Neo, indeed. Hitman Keanu is pursued by an old friend. Insert your Alex Winter joke here.
Well, that's not nice.
Ouija. A group of friends confront their fears when they awaken dark powers of Hasbro's trademark ancient spirit board. It is a Ouija board, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Ouija board?
But aren't the Transformers Hasbro's dark powers? That's not what I consider them to be.
Out in limited release, we have several movies opening in Chicago of note, including Listen Up Philip, covered in detail last week on the show as we had an interview with Alex Ross Perry, the director and writer, and Jason Schwartzman, the star. That movie playing now at the Music Box. A new film called 23 Blast, about a football star who's stricken with blindness, and it's all about whether or not he can return to the game he loves, directed by Dylan Baker.
Well, how about that?
Like the Dylan
His
Baker of
first,
happiness.
Right,
and
yeah.
I think it might be.
Okay.
The Blue Room, an erotic thriller directed by and starring Mathieu Amalric, has a 71 on Metacritic. Has to be good, Josh. And a movie I do really want to see played here at the Chicago Film Festival, Dear White People. It was also a special jury prize winner at Sundance for director Justin Simien. It's a college set comedy that satirizes race relations. Stonehurst Asylum also opening. A recent medical grad takes a position at a mental institution from the director of Session 9 and The Machinist, Brad Anderson. It's got a pretty stellar cast here. Ben Kingsley, Michael Caine, Brendan Gleeson, David Thewlis, Jim Sturgess, and Kate Beckinsale.
Wow.
It's a murderer's row of British actors.
One scene or something?
I don't know. Birdman, also opening, alas, we can see Michael Keaton in his big performance in Alejandro González Iñárritu's very meta-looking film, Birdman. That's the movie we're going to discuss next week on the show with the help of our friend Michael Phillips from the Tribune. And we are going to share our top five movie costumes that we'd wear. So if we were going to dress up for Halloween, which you do.
Yes.
I follow you on Facebook. We're friends on Facebook. And I noticed that you already have a costume picked out. So
I've got let's say a quarter of a costume is what that was. Now, we're not wearing costumes to this recording.
Oh,
right?
Of course we are.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.